Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. David Toomey writes books about research on the edge of science. Storm Chasers looked at daredevil pilots who gathered information about hurricanes by flying right into them in the days before weather satellites. The New Time Travelers examines research into the theoretical or at least hypothetical physics behind the possibility of actual travel through time. Toomey's new book is about the research into life at the very edge of what scientists think of as life. Professor Toomey heads the Professional Writing and Technical Communication Program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and his new book, Weird Life, looks at another scientific frontier, life and what defines it, even when that life is not at all like us. Professor Toomey, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you with us. And I'm wondering, when you first, what was the starting point with this book? What particular piece of information or question got you interested in this subject?
The starting point was probably a report by the National Research Council by a large group of scientists, mostly biologists and microbiologists, who had been tasked with the mission of defining life and imagining what sort of life might be very, very different from anything we know. And that seemed to me something that hadn't been thought about much and was worth a book.
And the book, the full title is Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own. Our guest is David Toomey, and as always, we welcome you to the conversation. You can call in with your questions or comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at willtalk, that's will-talk, at illinois.edu. Post comments on Facebook at WILL Radio TV Online, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is WILL Public Media. And David, your book opens with a chapter on life, real life, life we know about, found in environments that were previously considered hostile to life. Too hot, too cold, wrong chemicals around, whatever. What is it about this life that sets it apart from most other life?
What sets this apart is a matter of degree, not kind. These organisms collectively are called extremophiles, and they have been much in the media probably for the last 10 or 20 years. They have adapted to conditions of high pressure, of conditions of extreme heat and cold, and even to conditions of great amounts of radiation.
How do they do it?
It depends. They do it in many, many ways. If you're looking for what's called a halophile, that is a salt lover, there are organisms that live, in fact, in the Dead Sea, an environment that would seem hostile to you and me and to most life we think of as familiar life. Those organisms have cell membranes that are somewhat different than the cell membranes that are in your cells and my cells. They have a if you can't beat them, join them strategy too. They have the cytoplasm within the cells has a higher salt content. The extremophiles that live in under high pressures and high temperatures actually change some of the chemicals in their cells. They use molecules that don't break down under those high temperatures. So there's a great variety of strategies. There's no single organism that one calls extremophiles. There are a variety of them.
But their life related to us in terms that they all require water, they all require oxygen, etc.
Exactly, and if you look at their cells closely enough, you find that the chemical pathways, thousands of chemical pathways, are the ones we use. The DNA is like our DNA. All these and the basic their basic chemistry and biochemistry is like ours, all of which leads biologists to believe that we and they and every all familiar life, and extremophiles are a type of familiar life, they're an extreme type of familiar life, all are descended from a single common ancestor.
Now, that's a question we'll be getting to later, the single common ancestor question. Now, are any of these, I think you note that a lot of these life forms are microscopic. Are any of them not? Are any of them sizable to any degree?
No, all the extremophiles. Well, the most extreme extremophiles are microscopic. But there are tube worms, and I think these have been reported a great deal in the media, and they're not hard to find pictures of on the web. Tube worms are a creature that exists around the hydrothermal vents in the ocean floor.
And when we're talking about hydrothermal vents, we're talking about someplace where it's very hot.
Very hot, very high, a lot of water pressure. A lot of pressure from the ocean above it, and yes, very hot.
Okay, and they're probably not gigantic, are they?
They're, some are a foot or more.
Okay. Now, but as you note, that most of these extremophile life forms are microscopic, and your book also notes that most are from the domain Archaea, and that strikes a note here at the University of Illinois, since the late Carl Woese, who identified Archaea as a separate domain of life, was here at the university until his death just, I think, a couple of months ago. As a matter of fact, Dr. Woese was a guest on Focus, I believe, more than once over the years. What is it about Archaea that makes them different from other life?
What is it about Archaea? A number of things make them different, but I think to a non-scientist, what makes them different is that collectively they are best adapted to these extreme conditions.
And is there anything we can talk about in layman's terms besides the fact that they've been most successful? They don't look different in the microscope to the naked eye, I take it, from say bacteria that they were once considered to be a part of, but in some way they are different.
They don't look different they don't look different in a light microscope, but there are some fundamental chemical pathways that are different. Their biochemistry is, in some subtle but important ways, different. What Woese made clear is that they were a very early offshoot of the trunk that grew from the last universal common ancestor.
Okay, so still a universal common ancestor with us, but it's like a very distant relative.
Right.
Okay. This, I believe, you get to talking into your book the idea that about life forms that evolve separately from us, and perhaps the idea of life forms on Earth that could theoretically have developed completely independently on us from a completely different origin than the life as we know it category.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little more?
This is called the theory of a shadow biosphere. And this, in some ways, it's an old idea, but it is an idea that has been getting considerable press lately by a group of scientists, among them Paul Davies and a philosopher in Colorado, Carol Cleland. The thinking is that it is possible that there is a great many organisms, an entire ecology, an entire biosphere that lives, as it were, alongside us. And impinges on our biosphere, maybe slightly, maybe greatly, but is perhaps not even dependent on it. And a biosphere which had an entirely different origin than our own, the organisms in that biosphere, in other words, are not descended, if it exists, those organisms are not descended from the last universal common ancestor, but from our last universal common ancestor, but from another last universal common ancestor.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about weird life, things that are alive but not like you expect. David Toomey writes about the topic in his book, Weird Life, The Search for Life, that is very, very different from our own, new from W.W. Norton and Company. We welcome your questions and comments for our guest at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again are 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. So we're talking about the idea that there could be a whole nother body of life, not like us, here on Earth. They've been here the whole time, but they originated at a different origination point. They have their own biochemistry. We haven't confirmed that any of this exists, I take it.
No, we haven't. There have been efforts, and there have been a few false starts and false leads, but no, at present, the shadow biosphere remains theoretical.
For the people who are looking at it, what makes this concept so tantalizing?
It would be tantalizing not just for the people looking at it, I think, but for all of us. It would be evidence. It would be evidence that life exists or life is produced anywhere chemistry, complex chemistry, is around for long enough. It would be evidence. Well, one way to think of it is, all life we know is represented on a single phylogenetic tree. That's the familiar illustration that I think many of your listeners have seen. This would mean the existence of an entire other tree. And if there's one other tree, perhaps there's an entire forest. So what makes the idea tantalizing and intriguing and perhaps unsettling is that we in all life, would represent a smaller part of the universe than we now believe, or put another way, the universe would be vastly more interesting than we now believe.
Are the researchers who are thinking about this assuming that that the shadow biosphere would be creatures who are so different from us that, well, looking at animal and plant life as we know it, we look at creatures that essentially eat each other through a chain. Maybe their body chemistry for the shadow biosphere is so different that they can't interact with us in any way that's useful to them.
That's a possibility. They would eat things we wouldn't eat, or I should say familiar life wouldn't be interested in eating, and they would excrete what familiar life wouldn't even be bothered by, thus remain, as it were, invisible.
Is that where I noticed in your book a discussion about the role of arsenic in biology? Was that one of the questions that were brought up in the whole shadow biosphere theory?
Yes, there was a paper published in spring 2010, and there was a claim by a group of scientists who had found a microbe that, in their view, probably had substituted the phosphorus in its DNA or some of the phosphorus in its DNA with arsenic. That claim is now discredited, but that claim would have been those organisms, such organisms, had they existed, might have been part of a shadow biosphere.
We're talking with the shadow biosphere, I think, of mostly a microscopic realm.
Yes.
So, I mean, any big creatures would be more easily identified, but there just must be a challenge with microscopic creatures to just figure out what is what and what creatures are doing and what they're made out of.
It is, and or it would be. If anyone is doing it, but there are strategies for doing this. One way to think about it, the creatures that are ringing the hydrothermal vents, that is the very hot water that is issuing out of fissures in certain places in the ocean floor, the creatures surrounding those vents are only so close to it. Even they can stand water only so hot. Now, if you found the inner edge of their community, you found a place where they couldn't get closer. Then you looked a little further, a little closer to the vent, and found a second ring of creatures, or of microorganisms, I should say, or for all we know, not macroorganisms. If you found them, it'd be a good chance, it'd be a long way to prove it, but it'd be a good chance that they were another kind of life entirely. So that's one way to think about it. Another way would be to go to places where no life exists. There are parts of Chile's Atacama Desert, for instance, that seem to be utterly barren of life. If you could identify a microorganism there, bring it back to the lab and look at it, you might find that it was something else entirely.
And that's what the whole extremophile phenomenon is about, going in places where we didn't think there would be anything, mm-hmm. but finding something.
Right.
Okay. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're discussing weird life, not what's growing in your yogurt when you leave it in the fridge too long, but life even stranger than that. Our guest is David Toomey, whose new book examines what science knows and what it's trying to find out about life on the edge. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. We're on Facebook at WILL Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle is WILL Public Media, and those phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Just looking at the creatures what we have identified that have evolved, that seem to have evolved separately, the Archaea, which even though they have a common ancestor, have been on their own track. Do they pretty much do the same, come up with the same solutions to coping with their environment, or do they sometimes do something very different?
Both. The same solution to coping your environment, an evolutionary biologist calls convergent evolution. The most famous example is probably the eye of the human and the eye of the octopus. And both eyes are remarkably similar, even down to their details. This, despite the fact that humans and a human and an octopus are in most other ways about as different as is possible. So nature, evolution, does sometimes find the same solution to an environmental challenge. And this does often work. This often works at the microbial level too. Certain enzymes, many chemical pathways in creatures that are in all other ways very different, and didn't have that feature. Whose ancestors, I should say, didn't have that feature to develop that feature. So the answer to the question is, in some cases, yes.
But when there are differences, does it seem to be there are sometimes different ways to approach the same problem in life?
Yes, and the fact that there are different ways is what leads biochemists and microbiologists who think about alternative biologies to believe they're possible. The chemical pathways in a cell are only one way to do it, and a microbiologist with a lot of imagination, and there are many microbiologists with a great deal of imagination, can imagine and are imagining other ways to do the same job, all of which leads them to believe, again, that the way life has evolved in many ways is just happenstance. We picked that microbe way back when, for instance, picked phosphorus for its DNA because phosphorus was around, it was available, it was handy. It didn't pick arsenic only because there was no arsenic available. If arsenic had been available, then we'd all have arsenic in our DNA, and we'd be a rather different life form.
Well, besides looking for weird life on Earth, you also write about the efforts to detect life on Mars with the unmanned exploration probes that NASA has sent to Mars over the years. And part of their work was conducting tests for signs of life. And of course, this raises the questions, how do you know life when you see it? And so what sort of tests did they do, and what sort of questions does that raise?
How do you know life when you see it is the big question. And the answer, the short answer is no one is sure. There are ideas about how you know life when you see it. Carl Sagan's idea, and Carl Sagan was active in, participated in NASA's Viking program, the two unmanned probes, Martian landers sent to Mars, landed on Mars in the 1970s. And Sagan made the point that if you saw something that was top-heavy, it might be life. Wasn't definite, but it might be life. That is to say, you look at a tree, you look at a cow, or you look at a dandelion. There's a greater volume above the ground as it gets further away from the ground. That seems something that suggests what physicists calls thermodynamic disequilibrium. It's out of balance. It's not a definite biosignature, but it's a good place to begin. So that's one way. But as you can see, you know, it's very difficult to be sure. The original Viking experiments back in the 1970s made the assumption that anything that lives is going to ingest chemicals and is going to excrete chemicals. So if you found some sort of trading of that sort, you might be on your way to finding something living.
Well, they did those tests out on Mars, but they didn't find anything, did they?
That depends on who you ask. There were three tests, and the the designers of one of the tests, Gilbert Levin, continues to believe he thought he found something at the time, and he continues to believe he did. And there have been in recent years several scientists who revisited the results of the Viking tests and have found reason to think it's possible that we may have found something. Interestingly enough, something we weren't looking for, which is to say, most of those tests were designed with the presupposition that life would need liquid water. The rather more recent interpretations of the test is if there was life that didn't drink water, but instead drank hydrogen peroxide, then maybe we were seeing evidence of that life.
Does this inform any tests that may be done with future probes to Mars?
At present, there's no plans for there's nothing in development to test to test life for life on Mars. The Curiosity rover, which is on Mars right now, is looking for evidence of life. Not evidence of life directly, but is looking for the geological and chemical conditions that would make life possible. Should we start redesigning experiments to look for weird life? Many biologists would say yes, that would not be a bad idea. That, in fact, that was the recommendation of the National Research Council report.
But we have to get another probe scheduled first, I guess.
Yes, we do.
I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is David Toomey, author of Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest today is David Toomey, whose new book is about the life that scientists have discovered that's very different from us, the life they're trying to find, and ideas about life that they're thinking and arguing about. The title is Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own, from W.W. Norton. We welcome your questions and comments at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Like to say hello to a caller now from Belgium, not Belgium in Europe, but a much closer Belgium. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning, sir, and welcome to the new job.
Thank you.
What I would like to ask about your guest is he mentioned earlier about life seems to consume some sort of elements and then exudes something else. Well, what about the sun? It consumes hydrogen, produces larger elements, and exudes light, which also provides life for all the types of we normally consider life. Would you consider the sun a form of life?
And David, I think you actually brought up that idea in the book about whether in talking about definitions of life.
Right. The sun does all those. The sun is the sun, stars, candle flames. All of them are, one might say, born, they die, they have something like a metabolism, and as the caller says, yes, they consume and they excrete after a fashion. What the caller has hit upon is the real problem in defining life. Would I consider the sun living? I think I'd have to say no. But I would say the question's a very good one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. And, just getting up to the next point that I was wondering about, that's part of the problem, and I guess maybe you could even look at machinery of the right type and the right degree of unfamiliarity to us might look alive as well, for that matter, because it was using energy, maybe giving out some waste products, processing information. Potentially, it could look alive to a certain observer.
I know people who talk about their cars as though they're alive, and certainly cars do. They do consume. They produce waste. They move. They get old.
Well, if we're looking at life that evolved separately from us, whether here or on other planets, what sort of alternatives that scientists have thought of as to some of the other paths life could take?
Well, we could take these in degrees. What I do in the book is I move from weird to weirder to weirdest, and the slightly weirder might be simply substituting certain chemicals or certain chemical pathways. As I suggested, there are new interpretations of the Mars Viking data that suggest the possibility of microorganisms that did not use water as a biosolvent but instead used hydrogen peroxide. The authors of the National Research Council report were very interested in Saturn's moon Titan. This is because on Titan there are two liquids that might be used as a biosolvent. There is a slush made of ammonia and water, and there is liquid methane. And a number of scientists have imagined working biochemistries that used these liquids as biosolvents. So that is, those are slightly weirder. Some scientists, rather famous scientists, Fred Hoyle, the astronomer who coined the term Big Bang, imagined in a science fiction novel, imagined life made of a molecular cloud, a very loose organization of molecules and an electromagnetic field that could move of its own volition, that could, after a fashion, think.
And I had a little thrill reading about that in the book because I remember reading The Black Cloud many, many years ago. But that sort of raises the question because, obviously we haven't, to our knowledge, come across any sentient clouds anywhere. But it brings a question of how life begins, and that's something that we've never actually observed, the actual spark of life, of materials going from non-living to living.
Right, and that is an unanswered question. What's very clear to biologists that it is a complex process, and the real $64 question is life an inevitable consequence of complex chemistry or not? And the answer at present, the answer is no one knows.
In the case of Titan, I understand there was an unmanned ship that flew by Titan taking pictures. How much was it able to find out?
Well, the European Space Agency's Cassini probe is still in orbit around Titan, and it dropped a lander named Huygens onto the surface of Titan, and that lander was not it was not equipped to search for life per se. And again, such a search in a place like Titan, a search for weird life would have been much more demanding and problematic because one would have had to design a search for who knows what. But the lander did make a successful landing in what some of the mission scientists called a creme brulee crust. That is, there was a thin surface crust and it sunk a little bit into it. And the lander did detect methane on the surface. We do know that on Titan there are large lakes of liquid methane and ethane, and there is a kind of a cryomagma of an ammonia water slush coming from deep within. So Titan is a very, very interesting world, and what makes it very attractive to scientists who think about weird life is that it has liquid on its surface. Other than Earth, it's the only world we know of that has liquid on its surface, and it has evidently rivers, a lake as large as Lake Ontario, and rain.
And I'm wondering, because when we were talking about Mars a little bit earlier in the hour, your book does mention that Mars seems to fall into a sort of window in the solar system of where life, maybe life as we know it, is conceivable. Moons of Saturn, you would pretty much think, no, that's too far away, that's too cold. But could factors exist there that would allow the sort of chemistry that we think becomes life?
One reason the space around Saturn, or the space at a place in the solar system as distant from the sun as Saturn, would make life as we know it improbable is the water would be frozen. Water would be as hard as granite. What might mitigate that problem, if it is a problem, is that inside moons, for instance, Jupiter's moon Europa, rather famously, is known now as the moon which has an internal ocean. Most scientists believe that is. It has an ocean that is a water ocean. It may be very, very briny, but it is nonetheless water. And life, many astrobiologists believe that life in our own ocean, or certain types of life in our own ocean, certain organisms that exist in Antarctic ice flows, for instance, might be able to make a go of it in a European ocean.
Okay, and as that your book goes from there to places which seemed even less hospitable to life, but there's still thoughts of what could live on a comet, in a star, what life might evolve into eons from now. How serious is the speculation about those matters?
A lot of that has been talked about over the years. And as to how serious, well, I think the scientists who were writing about it were quite serious about it. The National Research Council mentions these ideas. It doesn't delve into them deeply, but Freeman Dyson, for instance, is a scientist who has talked about life in a very, very distant future, in which something like the molecular cloud that Fred Hoyle wrote about might actually come to pass. Another scientist, or an engineer physicist named Robert Forward, wrote a science fiction novel about hypothetical creatures the size of a sesame seed that live on the surface of a neutron star. And how serious that is? Well, it's serious enough that Freud published a rather scientific, that is not science fiction, but a serious article in the journal New Scientist.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions or comments for David Toomey. He's the author of the book Weird Life. Our phone number's 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, are toll free at 800-222-WILL. And noting just as you did a moment ago, scientists thinking speculatively and science fiction, which also speculates in matters of science, and you devote a chapter just to the science fiction thinking about life. What's the difference in terms of thinking as a scientist and thinking as a science fiction writer?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have a ready answer. I suppose it depends on the science fiction writer. Some are more try very deliberately to be more faithful to the science itself, to what we know to be true in the universe. Some allow their imagination a much freer rein. I made the point in the beginning of the chapter that a lot of science fiction, a lot of aliens in science fiction aren't truly weird. They are at least intelligent aliens. Many of them, they are human civilizations dressed up a little bit with pointy ears or blue skin or something. The very weirdest organisms depicted in science fiction are rather few and far between. And as it happens, most of those have been imagined by science fiction writers who are scientists, who are practicing scientists, and do a little science fiction on the side.
We have a call in, and I'd like to say good morning from, is it Denzel, if I'm correct, from Champaign? Good morning. You're on the air.
Sure, and good morning.
Hi, Denzel.
Hello. I'm calling to find out just what steps do we need to take to prove these facts from the other planets, and how do we begin to come to realize that this is actually true?
How do we go from speculation and hypothesizing to actually finding the data?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. We won't be able to do it without a serious investment in time and human energy. At least I think that's the case with discovering weird life elsewhere, that is, on other worlds. Now, the scientists interested in the shadow biosphere on Earth would say, if we're looking for that, we just might rather easily and at relatively little cost devise experiments. I talked about this a bit earlier. You look in places on Earth where familiar life doesn't exist. If we found some of that, we would have there'd be a good chance that it might be truly weird, truly something other.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I'm wondering, I'm wondering, Professor Toomey, is we're talking about things that could be done right here on this planet to do the research. Is there anybody who's going to pay for that sort of thing?
Sure, sure. These are not. I mean, the experiments that are possible here are not all that costly, and the search for the arsenic-based organism or arsenic-using organism in Mono Lake in spring of 2010 was a government-funded project, and certainly in relation to a probe to Mars, a very modest one.
We have another caller now on line one, Mark from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thanks. It sounds like I may have missed it while you were talking, answering a previous question, but that is, what other types of chemistry might life be based around? You mentioned arsenic. Might there be life based around silicon? Might there be different variations of carbon-based life? I mean, what sorts of things could we be looking for?
All of the above would be the short answer. You mentioned silicon. Silicon is all familiar life uses carbon as a binding molecule, and silicon-based life is at present fairly theoretical. And through the years, I think it's fair to say that most biologists thought it unlikely. One, for a number of reasons, silicon is a lot like carbon, but not enough like carbon to really build complex biochemistry. That prevailing idea has been challenged recently by a British scientist named William Baines, and Baines makes the point that we're thinking about life at the wrong temperature. If we look at much colder temperatures, temperatures like those that would exist on Saturn's moon Titan, or colder than that even, silicon's bonds become active again, and carbon just about freezes up, but silicon comes into the game then. But the answer to your question there is all those things you mentioned are possible.
I'm wondering at that point, since we haven't actually seen any silicon-based life forms as far as we know, has it been possible to create the sort of chemicals which would be building blocks for life that are silicon-based?
There is a field of chemistry, cryogenic chemistry, that does experiment with large, complex molecules that are based in silicon. How close that is to life, is another question. Or even how close it is to chemistry, I think, is another question. But complex chemistry is certainly possible.
You write that in your book that no weird life has been found yet, although we've certainly found some very unusual life. And there's a lot of science looking at these questions, or at least asking these questions. Somebody, and maybe the people who would pay for this sort of research, are going to wonder the purpose of looking at this point. Are there practical, what some people would call practical reasons for asking these sort of questions about life?
Are there practical reasons? It's hard to say right now. I don't know exactly where I separate the theoretical and the profound and the philosophical and the practical, honestly. I do think another form, an entirely different phylogenetic tree, would make a profound difference in the way not just biologists, not just life scientists, but all of us thought of ourselves, and how that would filter into a practical needs and a practical world. I think I'm not prepared to say, but I'm sure it would.
It's not the build the better mousetrap, cure the common cold sort of question, but it sounds like it would change the way we think about ourselves in relation to the universe.
It is, yes. There are biologists doing work in synthetic biology that are imagining that have developed chemistries that might contribute, or that have contributed to an AIDS vaccine, for instance. But that is a kind of a different branch of this inquiry. This inquiry itself, I don't think it exactly has an immediate practical end. But then again, most science at its beginning doesn't.
Well, Professor Toomey, thank you very much for being on Focus with us this hour. It's been a fascinating subject to talk about.
Thank you.
David Toomey is the author of Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own. That's a new book from W.W. Norton & Company. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside our listening area, let them know we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. And Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll be talking with the head honchos at the University of Illinois, U of I President Robert Easter and Urbana Campus Chancellor Phyllis Wise will be in the studio with me, ready to take your questions about issues facing the university. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. Thank you for being with me on my first day as the interim host of Focus. Our best wishes to Craig Cohen beginning a new job in Houston, Texas.